Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him. We're happy that Dr. Ernest M. Ligon of Schenectady, New York, is with us today to give the second in a series of three meditations on the Lord's Prayer. Following our worship service today, you're invited to come down to the front and ask Dr. Ligon any questions which may be on your minds and hearts. For our lesson of the morning, we turn to the Gospel according to Matthew, the 6th chapter. And when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward. But when you pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And in praying, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Pray then like this. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
May I announce tomorrow morning's hymn now so that you can practice it. It'll be number 318.
In case you folks up there hadn't discovered it, I thought I'd tell you now.
If the choir will be at all tractable, as I hope they will be.
I hope they'll sing tomorrow morning the other Lord's Prayer hymn. Would you be willing to do that? Appreciate it very much. That's my favorite piece of music of all the music that was ever written, and I'd love to hear you sing it.
Yesterday morning, we started out with three conversations about the Lord's Prayer. As I told you then, I think the Lord's Prayer is the most powerful blueprint for spiritual thinking that ever was created in the whole history of the world. And I think we have very badly abused it in the process of reciting it on Sunday morning so much. I remember, as I told you yesterday, that this preacher who came out to this boys' camp that I was talking about, when they took 17 minutes to pray it, made the remark to me afterwards. He said, I have recited the Lord's Prayer all my life, but this is the first time I have ever prayed it. It's a powerful prayer, and if you want to think through your problems in terms of it, once you have mastered or have explored some of its depths, you will find it a powerful thing to do. And yesterday morning we talked about our Father who art in heaven, and hallowed be thy name. The next group of petitions, I think, at least can have to do with what you're going to do. They can range all the way from making a decision about what you'll do with your life work at the one extreme to what you'll do in the next hour at the other extreme. But when purpose and the purpose of your life and why you were put here to live, you make that decision on the basis and with the help of the next group of petitions. Let's look at them a little carefully. And look at them a little bit in terms of statistical decision theory. Thy kingdom come is the next one. I suppose a good many of us are not in the remotest interested in the kingdom of Christ coming. Read the description of it and you'll be surprised sometime. I think we've perhaps done a fairly bad job in the history of religion in describing heaven in attractive terms. The old Literary Digest, the magazine that went defunct trying to predict a presidential election, published a questionnaire, and the questionnaire had been built this way, that a man had taken all of the literary descriptions of heaven and all of the literary descriptions of hell and translated them into characteristics of a hometown. And a number of high school and college young people were asked to check off these various characteristics as to which they would like to have characteristic of their hometown. And hell outdrew heaven about 10-1 in that. Because we've done such a bad job, I just can find myself totally unexcited about sitting on a cloud and playing a harp for a million years. I don't want to even play a harp for 15 minutes. I'm perfectly willing for somebody else to. And for a million years, I would be completely and thoroughly bored with the experience. And I think we need to begin to get some more powerful pictures of what life would be like under Jesus' teaching. If you examine Jesus' commands to people, he never asked them to rest. He didn't ask the sick of the palsy to stay in bed and obey his nurse. He said, get up, take up your bed, walk, follow me, and I will make you a fisher of men. You'll have to give up your home. You won't even know where you're going to sleep next. Everything that he commanded people to do, and I have a notion heaven must be a good deal like that. I happen to have the very good fortune to have probably the best job that any man in all history ever had. And I confess that if I died and went to heaven tonight and St. Peter wanted to know what I wanted to do, I couldn't improve on what I'm doing. And I hope that the job can be continued when I get there, if I do. The case may be. But now let's see what it means in terms of decision theory. And in decision theory, this may surprise you a little, and until you have thought about it a while, you won't realize its full significance. But when you're trying to make a decision by decision theory, you always consider at least two hypotheses. In our own laboratory, we disobey that from time to time. Someone will make a suggestion, wouldn't it be fine to do this? And everybody else agrees, yes, that would be fine to do, and we set out to do it. And more often than not, we regret that we set out to do it. And so we need, every time we make such a decision, to always consider some other decision, usually the opposite. We've used things and used techniques for, I suppose, 1,000 years in the history of character education, for instance, that never worked once. My pet illustrations, many of you have heard me give many times. I don't think I gave it yesterday morning, but if I did, repetition is the second step in the learning process. And so you'll remember it better. But here is a father who has two sons, and the older boy hits the younger boy. And the father says to the older, hits the older boy with this brilliant remark. This is so you'll know how it feels to be hit. Now, to realize how completely absurd that is, all you've got to do is to imagine the older boy responding that by saying, bless my soul, why didn't somebody tell me this before? I never dreamed how it felt to be hit. I'll never hit my younger brother again. Now, of course, what happened was that he got the younger brother out behind the woodshed or the barn or the house or wherever it was and hit him twice as hard. Some people have suggested that maybe that was the reason Cain killed Abel, was because Adam tried it on Cain. But be that as it may, taking only a single hypothesis and never questioning that hypothesis never leads to wise decision. So no matter how good your idea may seem to be at the moment, do it differently. May I describe a process that we have in our own laboratory, which has been one of the richest ones we've had that will make this come to life, I think. We call it creative conflict. Supposing Dr. Coker were a member of my staff, and we had both examined a body of evidence and tried to arrive at an hypothesis that would explain that evidence. And supposing when we shared our experiences that we came out with the same answer, would that be fine? Oh, quite the contrary. Both of us would be deeply depressed. Because nothing can come from it. As a matter of fact, that would mean if we published a curriculum, and if everybody wrote in about that curriculum and said, it's wonderful, it's marvelous, that would be a tragedy. Because if God is infinite, we shall never exhaust any important aspect of his truth. No matter how good a curriculum we've got, there must be a far better one, and it's only by the mistakes that we learn. But if Dr. Coker and I were a member of, if Dr. Coker were a member of my staff and we had this experience, and if I interpreted the data one way and he interpreted it another way, then how would we go about it? Would I try to convince him and he me? Not at all. He would make the assumption that because I disagreed with him, I must have seen something he didn't see. And I would make the assumption that because he disagreed with me, he must have seen something that I didn't see. And that if we would sit there, share our experiences long enough and hard enough, we would come up with a third alternative, as we call it, a third concept infinitely better than either one of us went into that experience. And we do that almost daily in our laboratory. It's one of the most powerful techniques we have. So you can see why, and as a matter of fact, very few of the concepts that come out of our laboratory could be assigned to any person. We never say Sally Smith discovered this, or Bill Coppy discovered this, or Ernest Ligon discovered this, because it seldom ever happens that way. Most of the time, it comes out of this experience of creative conflict. So when you say, thy kingdom come, don't make the tacit assumption that you know what that kingdom is like. Make the tacit assumption that in all probability your picture of it is a mixture of maybe what it is like plus your own personal prejudices. And that if you'll have someone else who has a different point of view than you, share that experience with you, that you're both likely to come out with a lot closer picture to what the kingdom is like. So that's your first task then, in trying to decide what you're going to do. Consider at least two hypotheses. And find throughout this creative conflict a better answer than you could possibly have gone into the experience. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I've heard people use that as a good excuse for whatever happened to them as a result of their sins over a period of time. I've seen people who ate themselves half to death, and then when they were just about at that point of being half to death, they have bowed their heads very sanctimoniously and said, thy will, not mine, be done. When, of course, it wasn't the Lord's will that they gorged themselves that way in the first place. And they make it a surrender type of reaction. I don't believe it is. I think that when Jesus said, thy will, not mine, be done, that it was something powerful. Think of that prayer at the Garden of Gethsemane. When he said, if it be possible, take this cup from me. But it's not my will, but thine which must be done. That was not a statement of surrender in a negative sense. If it was surrender, it was surrender in a determined and a positive sense. I think here we need to use every resource we've got, all that research methods can teach us, all that the scientific method can help, every bit of our brains, every bit of our energy, every bit of our resources to try to find out what is that will of God. One of you asked me yesterday, are you sure you're leaving enough room for the grace of God? Are you putting all of the emphasis on what man can do? And I tried to answer it, I hope, with some humility, perhaps in this fashion. I took my first course in statistics almost 40 years ago. I've been deeply interested in statistics ever since, and now I teach it. But when a student comes into my class who has never had a day of statistics, I don't worry about him outdoing me statistically in the first 2 or 3 months. He can try his dead level best, and I will still know far more statistics than he does. And the last thing I'd want him to do is not study. I want him to study hard, because when I get a class that doesn't study, I can't do anything with it at all. I'm perfectly certain, at least the God that I believe in, and I imagine the God that you believe in, that when we've done everything we can possibly do, when we've thrown every ounce of intelligence and skill and resources into it, there'll still be plenty of room for the grace of God. That he hasn't got a thing to worry about that we will outdo him at all. So the grace of God has come into the picture. If there were time, I'd tell you of numerous experiences in our own thinking. For instance, after I had written The Psychology of Christian Personality, just at the very end of that, Dr. Wells of the Westminster Presbyterian Church of Albany invited me to make the series of lectures in his church. Not before then, not after then, just at that point. I never heard of Dr. Wells, and I'm sure he never heard of me except as a potential speaker. And there began the research into the thing. And when we had gone as far as we could go without any further resources, here comes a letter to me. I didn't write to him. He wrote to me from Mr. Eli Lilly, stating, I've heard of your project, and I'm interested in it. Would you and Mrs. Ligon be my house guests? I want to talk to you. And when I left his home, he gave me a check for $5,000, and since that time has given us over $1.5 million. But I didn't invent Mr. Lilly, the Lord did. And every time we've had to have something that we couldn't handle, the Lord has been right there. I don't know where we're going. One of my own staff, Bill Coppy, came on our staff. Brilliant young psychologist. Last year had an offer to be chairman of a department out in the Midwest where he'd make twice as much as he's making now. Far more prestige position. And I said, Bill, you've got a wife and 3 children. We don't know where money's coming from 2 years from now. Don't you think you'd better look for some security? Bill just smiled and said, well, the Lord's taken care of you all these years. I guess he will me. And so there Bill stays, and I suspect he's right. The Lord will. Well, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, then. We mean to use every ounce of evidence we can possibly get to solve that problem. As I think of the role of the home in the years that are to come, we talked about it in this last class very extensively. I'm sure it's going to be the greatest role in the whole history of mankind. In fact, I'm pretty certain that unless the home can find its power and find its role, if you please, and do it efficiently, that we won't have a civilization very much longer. And I suspect that you young people sitting here as the spiritual leaders of tomorrow have got to find out a lot about that. I know some of you already, for instance, are participating in our family challenge, which is a research project to find more about the role of the home in tomorrow. I hope more of you will. But whether you do or not, I hope all of you will realize that unless we can build into the home the power that is there, we're not likely to have it. Not likely to find out the answer to that prayer, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. That's a hard one to describe, too, and I can't describe it easily in a minute or so from a decision theory point of view, so let me give an illustration. I think it's the realistic part of the prayer. We preachers have a tendency to stand in the pulpit and ask our congregation to become Christians overnight. We say, go out and be Christians immediately. And that's quite a job. It isn't so easily done. Mrs. Smith did her master's degree study on a maturity study, and she found that young people or children tend to grow up and mature in three different ways. One of those ways, of course, is just the biological process of growing up in height and weight and the other physical characteristics. But a second one is that they tend to grow up in idealism, to get the ideals and to see the visions of the ideals. But also they tend to grow up in realism, to see life as it actually is. She also found that girls tend to grow up more rapidly in idealism. Boys tend to grow up more rapidly in realism. And you'll find that as you preach to your congregations, that it is the men who tend to be the realistic side of the congregation and the women who tend to be the idealistic side of the congregation. And when we say, give us this day our daily bread, it seems to me that one of the things we're saying is, how can we make our highest idealism realistic, and how can we make our most real realism idealistic? Maybe that's the role of father and mother in the home. Maybe it's the role of men and women in the world, but to find out how we are to accomplish that. Now, maybe I haven't said enough of that to make it fully meaningful to you, but it's a very powerful part of the prayer. In addition to that, it's what can I do today that needs to be done? And so many of us tend to put off the great jobs until sometime when we've got lots of time to accomplish something. But each day, if we do some job, that's the thing that's involved there, too. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. That petition took more of my time during the writing of The Psychology of Christian Personality than any part of the prayer. Finding out what it meant, I could think of asking God to forgive me, but what comparably could it amount to in terms of my forgiving someone else? If God's forgiveness were no bigger than mine, so that I said, forgive me my debts as I forgive others their debt, what kind of forgiveness could I possibly have that was comparable to that? And then suddenly, I discovered this kind of thing. Who is the person who is most likely to become my debtor? Well, if you become angry with me, my temptation and my nature is to become angry back again. If you become deeply afraid, my temptation is to be absorbed by that fear. But supposing when you become angry with me, from God's great store of strength, I can keep love and return love for that anger. And supposing when you have deep fear, that from God's great store, I can find courage and confidence to return for that fear. Then perhaps I can change your anger into confidence and change your fear into courage. Think that through and see if it doesn't say what is involved in forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, just a little part of it. Again, I wish I had time to follow through on the statistical theory of decision theory there too. But that has a lot to do with trying to think what we're going to do with our lives, particularly as those lives touch other people's lives. And then the last petition that I want to deal with this morning in this talk is lead us. Now, of course, in our prayer, we tend to say, lead us not into temptation. Personally, I think it's a mistake. And after I had read all that I could find out about it, I feel perfectly certain that the lead us stood out all by itself. Maybe one of the reasons why we have put us, lead us not into temptation, is that we didn't quite have the courage to say, lead us. That just as Gideon found that a large share of the people were unwilling to follow him. So maybe we just don't have the courage after we look at all the things that Jesus taught, which demanded us to love our enemies, returning good for evil, and all those powerful things. We don't quite have the courage to do it. Some of us would rather be self-made men and self-made women. And I must say that all of those I've seen certainly show that they were self-made. On the contrary, we need to be able to say, and you have to ask the question very strongly, are we honestly willing in the purpose that we're going to try to carry out today or tomorrow or with our lives? Are we willing to follow through and do precisely what Jesus had us do? Dr. Coker is saying to some of you who think you'd like to join the Family Challenge, are you sure you would? Are you sure you're willing to invest the time, the energy, the work that it's going to take to do this? Don't start unless you are. And you need to say that about all of us. So when you say lead us, that's what's involved in this kind of a picture. All right, there they are then. When you're making decision for your life purpose, you say, thy kingdom come, if you can. And make up your mind at that point. You may want to stop the prayer at that point. You may decide that you really don't want to go any further. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. You may decide that you like your will far better, and you may stop at that point. Give us this day our daily bread. You may want to put off until tomorrow the things that need to be done today. You may see life as realistic and not be willing to carry through. Many a young person has refused to teach children, for instance, to turn the other cheek because he didn't believe it could be worked. He believed that it was over-idealistic. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. We may have so much anger, so much fear, so much hate, so much suspicion in our makeup that we can't pray that prayer. And having done it all, lead us. Are we willing honestly with all our hearts and souls, recognizing the full power and all of the implications and all of the danger that's involved in Jesus' message, to honestly say with our whole hearts, lead us? Let us pray. Our Father who art in heaven, we'll try to believe that thou art a Father as we look at the world around us and as we look at what happens in it. We'll try to keep a faith that thou art good. Hallowed be thy name. Keep us living lives that will bring honor to thy name. Thy kingdom come. As we look at the things we want, we don't always believe that. But this morning, we will try to dedicate ourselves again to bringing in the kind of a kingdom that Jesus talked about when he walked through Galilee, no matter what the consequences to us. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Help us to search for thy will, never a moment imagining that we can comprehend all of it, but that we'll keep trying to find more of it with whatever resources we can bring to bear in our efforts to do so. Give us this day our daily bread. Each day do the job that is to be done that day, never letting the realisms of the moment for a moment change the idealisms that are behind Jesus' gospel, nor never letting the idealisms in Jesus' gospel bring us out of contact with the realism of the world around us. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Help us when we face fear and anger and hate and suspicion to be able to return it with faith and love, high vision and the positive. Lead us. This morning, if we've gone far enough in the prayer, we can say with our hearts and souls, as we leave this room, and as we meet our classes, lead us. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.